Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. So this episode is number 11, and my guest here was Kate Cross. And Kate is an English international cricket player who also plays for Lancashire at domestic level. She is also the host of the No Balls Cricket podcast. Kate was, at the age of 16, she was the first ever female to be accepted into the Lancashire Cricket Academy. And in April 2014, she was one of 18 women to get a professional contract in cricket. And that's huge, really. If you think, imagine playing a sport that you love since you were a kid and playing it for years and being good at it, but just thinking that it's just something you were going to do and you couldn't really make any money from it because that didn't actually exist. And then to go professional overnight and suddenly everything's changed and the money's changed and the media's changed and you're on Sky Sports and suddenly you're open to more criticism and you're open to more conversation and more in the public eye. I mean, that's quite an intense thing to happen, I think. And it was really great to chat to Kate about that. She was really open and honest about her story. And yeah, it's just a really, really cool conversation. We talk about identity and we talk about the importance of creating a safe space that you can be open and talking to people in. And yeah, it's just brilliant. And Kate's really, really cool to talk to because she has clearly done a lot of work on herself. You know, she really understands herself and the things that she's been through and the things that have happened to her. And because of that, she has a fantastic way of looking at things and of breaking stuff down. And I personally really identified with some of the things that she was talking about, and it's actually made me think about some of the things that I have to deal with in a very, very similar way. So I found this one quite enlightening. So for me personally, yeah, this was a fantastic episode. So I got to admit, I know very little about cricket. And I saw on Twitter, someone had retweeted one of Kate's posts. And I just thought it was brilliant. It was so open, so honest. And she was basically talking about like mental health and how we use social media to talk about it one week of the year. And then through the rest of the year, just pretend that everything's fine, even though a lot of people are struggling. And I really liked the sentiment behind it. And I thought it was really brave. You know, she talked about her own experience there. And I just thought it was exactly the sort of thing that we need more of. So I dropped her a message and she got back to me really quickly. And we swapped a few emails. And within the week, we were sitting down recording this chat. And yeah, I think it's brilliant. I'm really proud of it. I'm really happy with how it came out. And yeah, Kate is just really cool. She was just really, really fun to talk to. So if you want to find out more about Kate, she is at Crossy16 on Instagram. On Twitter, she is at KateCross16. And you can also check out her podcast at NoBallsTCP. And yeah, thank you very much for listening. If you do listen, if you do like this one, please give us a review. Please subscribe. Please take a screenshot and tag us in your story. And if you want to have a little chat and go back and forth about it, by all means, drop us a message. You can find the podcast at Proper Mental Podcast on all social media platforms. We're always happy to chat if you want to give us a shout. So that's it. Episode 11 of the Proper Mental Podcast on a Thursday with England international cricketer Kate Cross. So here's another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast, and it's Tom here, and today I am joined by Kate Cross. Hiya, Kate.
Hiya, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Oh, fantastic. Have you been training today, Kate?
Yeah, I'm down in Loughborough, which is, please don't think that this is in my bedroom. I realise we're on a podcast, but showing you this picture behind me. Yeah, down in Loughborough. We train here pretty regularly now, actually. We're down here 4 days a week, so what day is it today? Tuesday? We're here till Thursday. Anyway.
Oh, cool.
You lose track.
Yeah, it's easily done at the moment, right? How's the pandemic kind of affected cricket and stuff like that? Is it? Are you waiting for a season to start at the moment, or?
Yeah, it actually feels relatively normal at the moment. We've actually just come back from New Zealand, which is obviously a COVID-free country. So we were very lucky. We got 7 weeks out there.
Wow. Yeah, I bet that must have been a bit of a shock, right? Just to be normal.
It was just a relief, to be honest. It kind of feels like my winter's been completely like split in two, which was nice because I feel like everyone like all over the country at the minute needs, well, all over the world actually, is kind of ready for that release, aren't they? And we're getting drips of it with the shops being back open and things like that. But yeah, New Zealand was just incredible because it was just normality again. Which it was funny, actually, a few people said to me, does it feel different? But it was the first time we'd been on an away tour since Australia, which was March 2020, so before the pandemic had hit. So it actually just felt like we were away on tour. You know, it didn't feel drastically different because we weren't in the UK.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, we were affected really quite drastically last year. We only played 5 international games and there wasn't much domestic cricket either. So yeah, it was affected, but I think that's just everyone, isn't it? Everyone's kind of been affected in some way at some point. So we're just really lucky that we're able to get, well, we're lucky we've got the biosecure bubbles now that, you know, we're able to play, and we were able to play last summer under those restrictions. But yeah, just kind of battling through a bit like everyone else, I think.
Yeah, that's it. I find it really fascinating because we've all lived through the same time period, through the same thing, and yet everyone's individual experience of it is so radically different. You know, it's like a real interesting time in that respect. Yeah,
and I think we're seeing that with the way that all different countries are dealing with it, haven't we? You know, we're all getting to the same end point, but how people have got there has been very different. So I know we weren't, no one envied us maybe about 4 or 5 months ago, but now obviously with the vaccine, we're looking like we're in a good place with that. So yeah, it's just a fascinating time, I think, and it's just been so just drastic, hasn't it? It's just, you couldn't write anything like this, and I don't think anyone's had a blueprint for it or how to deal with it, and we've kind of had to learn as we go.
Something about, you know, the idea of a new normal is quite nice, right? Can kind of maybe leave a few things behind in the pandemic and start afresh almost.
Yeah, I do hope it's given people a bit of perspective though. That certainly was something that hit me last summer. You know, cricket is my life. It's every day. It's every meal that I choose to eat. It's every night's sleep that I have. It's literally everything, because you like being an athlete's not a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, sure.
And I think I got to the point where, you know, I was like, my family being safe is actually the most important thing. Whether I play cricket or not again doesn't really matter. Now I'm back into the, I really want to play cricket again. My family have had the jab and everyone's going to be safe. So, you know, like my perspectives have flipped again, but I think hopefully it's just given people that, I guess, realization that there was things that we relied on that you didn't need to rely on. And actually I've noticed a lot more people getting outdoors, and I know we'll probably talk a lot about mental health in the next half an hour or so, but yeah, that's, I think for me, it's been people realizing what they've got and not, you know, that kind of striving for things that actually don't really matter.
Yeah, definitely. Modern life is so fast, isn't it? You know, and it's like a global opportunity just to slow that pace down.
Yeah,
and you know, you mentioned mental health there. You know, part of when you are, you know, dealing with something, then, you know, a lot of the strategies do involve slowing things down to just, you know, process stuff and you know, all that sort of stuff. But I'm just kind of leaping ahead there, mate, really. But
sorry.
I've got to confess, I know very little about cricket.
I know very little at all about cricket.
One thing I was thinking about today, I was like, cricket, probably more than any other sport, seems to be a real, almost family affair. So like with football, for instance, you might get like dad and one kid likes football, but mum and the other kid don't. But with a lot of cricket, it tends to be like you get cricket families, you know, all my mates who like cricket, it tends to be mum, dad, brother, sister, and they're all into it. Was that the case for yourself or?
Yeah, I've never thought about it like that actually. But yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on. My dad was a professional footballer. So we had kind of multiple sports in our family, but I think cricket, and I think the reason, if I can kind of assume why that might happen, is because it is such a big part of your life. It's not a 90-minute game of football that you turn up to, have a beer with your mates in the pub afterwards and then go home. Yeah. It is like all day, every day. So for me growing up, my local cricket club, which was Haywood, was where my brother, my older brother played, my dad played, my uncle played. All the males in the family, by the way, that's how I got into it. You know, I'm very male dominated. But my week, so I'm at school Monday to Friday, and then at the weekend, I'm just down at the cricket club all day, every day. So I think it's like, it just kind of consumes you. It's a sport that consumes you. And like test match cricket is 5 days worth of cricket. You know, you can't get away from it. So I think that's why. I think if you kind of marry into a family where they like cricket, you have to kind of invest in it. Which I, you know, that's been a massive part of my life and my childhood. So I'll, you know, never regret that. And I think I'll take that with me and hopefully kind of show that investment into my kids and the next generations of my family.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And to kind of go from like them playing as a child to cricket, then becoming your job. I suppose it's not a very traditional route into sport because the women's game wasn't professional when you started, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I didn't ever think that I would make a career out of cricket, maybe in punditry, possibly. But no, I went to school, did my GCSEs, A-levels, went to uni to get a degree because, like you said, that it just wasn't professional. It was 2014 that we turned professional, so not even 10 years. And now we're kind of seeing that filtered down. So we're only professionalised at the very top level. So if you played international cricket, you were a professional cricketer. But else, like, below those levels, it was never professional, which added a kind of different level of stress and pressure, because if you lost your England contract, you go into the job centre and finding a job doing something that's like, you know, not what you're used to, because there's just not those opportunities to filter down into the county or the domestic system. But yeah, I always put a lot of pressure on myself at school to make sure that I like balanced my cricket. I played a lot of netball as well. So I was quite a busy kid, but always made sure that school came first, because that was how I was going to make a living. It was never going to be through cricket.
Yeah, yeah. So it kind of, it must have just, when that opportunity arose, that must have suddenly been a sort of a big deal, I suppose. Sort of, did you see it coming? Was it like rumoured for a couple of years it was going to happen, or?
Literally not at all. We went and played an Ashes in Australia, which was when I made my test debut. So this was January 2014. And we got an email when we came back from that, because we'd done back-to-back Ashes, so we won both series. And we just got this email from the ECB saying that they want to invest in us and they're going to give us professional contracts. And I think I'd literally finished the uni in the June before that. So for me, my transition was perfect, because I was coming out of university, thought I'll give myself a year to, you know, find my feet, maybe do a gap year, go travelling. And then these contracts came around. So it was really perfect timing for me. And there's a lot of girls my age actually in this generation of this squad as well. So we were kind of all in the same boat where, we got that email, but it was from my point of view, it was never in the pipeline. It was never something to aspire to. It was just kind of literally happened overnight.
Wow. Yeah. Cause that's a huge change, right? Just to get an email and then bang, everything's changed.
Yeah. And it was funny because it was, there was a lot of media around it, obviously, because it was big news. But the expectation level that went on us as a team once we signed those contracts was phenomenal. You know, we were just expected to be world beaters and, you know, dominate the women's cricket scene. And actually nothing really had changed. How we trained had been relatively professional, probably in the 5 years leading up to 2014. And we always took pride in ourselves on how we were as a team, even though we weren't being paid. And so nothing quite changed for us other than the status of being professional. And we actually lost a test match that summer, and the media absolutely hounded us for it, because wow, you know, how could you lose, you're being paid now. And the money that we were on wasn't life-changing money. It was just enough to kind of keep you afloat without needing, well, we did need to subsidize for a while at the beginning, but you know, it wasn't game-changing money or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So that's a huge change. And I think, like, with, you know, something like football, if you get to a certain age and you're playing for a club, you can kind of see a particular path. And, you know, they probably have like media training and stuff at the big clubs, I would imagine. And then all of a sudden you're in the spotlight, so to speak. And that's got to be intense, huh?
It was more the scrutiny that we got. So it was always quite nice when we always enjoyed the men not doing well, because that then meant that we got more media attention. So this was before 2014, before we were professional. There was a particular Ashes series. I think it was that one, actually. We won that Ashes series in 2014 and the men didn't do very well. And everyone was saying, oh, send the girls out there. They know what to do.
So,
it was that kind of scrutiny. And when that changed and we became professional, the talk about it, it just stopped being like nicey-nicey, oh, the girls are doing it for a hobby, and which is what we wanted. Like, that was exactly what we wanted the media, you know, to treat us as an equal to the men's team and to actually look at our performances and scrutinise us. And it was just a really, really fascinating dynamic for about 3 or 4 years where it was all kind of evolving and changing and we were still finding our feet as professionals.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and something you've been really open about, Kate, is things that you've been through regarding your mental health. Was that something that you kind of brought with you to cricket, or is that something that kind of developed as you got further and further along the path to being a professional sports person?
I think it's really difficult for me to separate the two, and I've tried to do that in the past when I've been like searching for answers as to why I've felt how I've felt. The first thing I've looked to is cricket, because like I said, it's a big part of my life. But I first started really struggling with depression around my university years. And I was studying psychology at the time, and I kind of had this light bulb moment one day in class where we were doing symptoms of depression. And I could tick off like 9 out of 10 of these symptoms.
Wow.
And I kind of had that moment where I was like, right, finally, I know why I feel how I feel.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of a relief, actually. But then obviously I then had to have the conversation with my parents saying, I think, for me, it sounds daft, but it sounded really extreme to tell someone that I thought I had depression, because I had this life that people wanted. You know, I was, like I said, my dad was a professional footballer, so money has never been an issue in the family. You know, we didn't have a spoiled childhood, but, you know, I was lucky. I was put through school. I was put through university. Had a great boyfriend at the time. Just, you know, the things that I didn't have an answer for why I was feeling how I was feeling. And it frustrated me that I hadn't had a trigger moment that had caused me to feel that like loneliness and helplessness. I found it really difficult talking to my parents about it initially. And funnily enough, when I did bring it up with my mum, she said to me, she said, I was going to talk to you about this because I've noticed that you're just not yourself anymore.
Wow.
So everyone had kind of seen a change in me, but no one really knew how to approach it. So I think that's probably why I've been really open about my mental health, because I didn't see anyone talking about it really when I was that age. And whether it had helped me more or not, I'm not sure. But I think now I know that I've got a platform that I can help people with, which I just think is so important.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, in a way, I suppose, you know, being at university and being able to kind of like have that checklist in front of you and figure it out is quite handy, because that's almost like a shortcut, because sometimes when you don't know what's going on, you know, and sometimes people can spend a lot of time, can't they, going through something and they know something's happening, but they just don't know what it is. And then it's all right saying, oh, you know, it's good to talk about it, but how do you talk about something if you don't know what it is, if you can't express this thing that's going on?
And that was a big frustration for me, because I couldn't describe to anyone what I was going through. I physically didn't have the language to know how best to get what I was feeling across. And I think that frustrated my family a little bit as well, because my dad came from that era of, you know, like any injury that he ever had at football, it was just get some ice on it. You know, it's that kind of mentality. It was that man up kind of, not bravado, but it was always just crack on. And that old generation school, that old school generation of just, you never show your feelings really. But I'm terrible at actually not being able to express that. You know, I can't hide when I'm having a bad day, and I get tagged with that, you know, surly northerner, you know, a bit moody, a bit mardy, that kind of tag. And I just went along with that, and I was like, oh, right, well, yeah, that kind of fits with me when I'm having a bad day. But now there's obviously, I can explain that a lot more, because I know why I'm so low when I'm low. And like you said, that having that checklist just made me have that kind of sit up and realize moment that I needed help, and I needed external help. It wasn't just going to be something that went away.
Yeah, definitely. We often think as well, before we have these experiences, before we learn more about our own experiences, we kind of think of mental health as being like this big moment where something happens. And it's really interesting you mentioned about, you know, having such good like foundations and stuff around you, because then when you do tell your parents, I know when I spoke to my mom about, you know, things I was going through, straight away she was like, well, what is it, my fault, what have I done? And it's not, it's really hard to tell people it's not your fault, it's not a thing, nothing's happened, you know, I don't know what's happening, but it's not a, you know, I can't put it down to one specific moment. We think it's gonna be like a movie, isn't it, like Good Will Hunting, where you have a good cry and hug your therapist and everything's sorted, but yeah. It really doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Eh? And even on that, I recently, it was, the reason I put that social media post out at the weekend was because I had a bit of a breakdown last September, October. And even then I was nervous to tell my mum and dad that I was struggling again, because I remember saying to myself, don't let your parents worry about this, because you don't want, my dad's just turned 70, my mum's late 60s. Like, I didn't want them to have something else to worry about.
And yeah,
I'm not a parent, but I'm sure every parent worries about their kids all the time. Like, that's what my parents tell me, that, you know, at 2 a.m. in the morning, they're thinking about things that are in our lives, because that's what parenthood is. But I remember just, I didn't want them to worry about me being in a flat on my own in Manchester and, you know, adding another layer of stress to their lives. And that's nearly 10 years of going through kind of all these emotions and working through stuff and knowing what's right and get the support around you, get your parents involved because they're my big support network. And yeah, even then I still couldn't, you know, it was really difficult for me to tell them that I was struggling again. And it's now with hindsight, I think, why didn't you just pick up the phone straight away and let them know, because you know that helps you. But our psych that works with us at the ECB, she actually always says to me, she said, you can't psychoanalyze yourself. And even when you can, you know the right things and you know what to do, but it's still really difficult to do. But whereas if someone came to you with these symptoms, I would be able to say to them, right, do this, 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 this. And I'm pretty sure in a few weeks' time, you'll start feeling a little bit better. But when that's you, it's really hard to kind of, I guess, take yourself out of the moment to be able to put the right processes in place.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, if on a bad day, it really is all consuming and it feels like, you know, there won't be a good day. And then on a good day, it's like the bad day never happened. It's like it just doesn't exist. You know, like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
I just think it's why a lot of people why it takes them a lot longer to ask for help, because when it's bad, it's really bad. And then it finishes, people almost kind of go like, oh, what was that? Oh well, you know, I'll just leave it behind. And it's like it never happened.
Yeah. And this is why I wanted to put that post out at the weekend, because I'm in a really good place now. I've worked really hard since that kind of episode. And I've had a great amount of support around me, but I actually stumbled across that photo, and it took me by surprise that I'd taken it. I couldn't remember taking it.
Wow.
And I don't know what you're like, but when I have those kind of really, really dark moments, I don't remember much about them afterwards. I remember not feeling great and everything was bad and not, you know, not enjoyable. But then when I'm now in a good place, I find it quite difficult to pinpoint the moments and it all feels like a big blur.
Yeah.
So that seeing that photo gave me this real like kind of sit up and just think moment that, right, you're in a good place now. Don't just talk about mental health when it's mental health day or, you know, mental health awareness week, whatever it might be. You know, this is the part of it that people don't see. It's the part that your family see because you let them in. But actually, this is what everyone on social media should be aware of, because that's the bit that gets hidden so much because everyone's so embarrassed by it or feel like they should be embarrassed by it. And actually, that was my norm for 4 weeks. You know, that crying was just, it was a one-off photo, but that was literally every day of my life for 4 weeks. So why am I worried about showing that to people when I'm so keen to show them the best parts of my life and show them that I'm doing a helicopter ride in New Zealand? And, you know, I think it just gave me that realization that there should be a balance on my social media as well, because it isn't just all happy, smiley, playing cricket in the sunshine all the time. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, definitely. I love that as well, about talking about mental health when it's not mental health week and talking about it on good days and bad days and every day. And you know, if we're trying to normalize the conversation and take away the stigma, then that's the most important thing, right? It's just to just to talk about it on all days, not just the hashtag ones.
And I'm very lucky. I've got my own podcast, and it's not specifically designed around mental health. It's meant to be around cricket. We don't talk a great deal about cricket either, but the people that listen to that religiously, like they literally go on the journey with you. They see you on, we recorded a series straight after that, that like my episode. So I was kind of coming out the other side of it, but they got me for 3 weeks in that phase.
Wow.
And so I think that was really important as well, because it just gave a reality around what you're going through. And my best mate, who I do the podcast with, we're very good for each other in kind of helping each other through these darker times of our lives. But it just normalizes it for us now. So when I go on the podcast now and talk about, oh, I'm not having a great week, or, you know, I'm starting to feel a little bit low, it's just normal conversations for us and for our listeners to hear. So again, it's just that normalization around it. And yeah, that's again the point of my post at the weekend, was just that, not like, it isn't so normal to feel like that, and especially in the middle of this global pandemic where no one really knows whether they're coming or going and everything is just flipped upside down, that it's okay to feel like that.
Yeah I love that as well, that you can just be having a bad day and say, yeah, I'm having a bad day. You know, it makes so much difference when you get to a place that you can almost have that acceptance around it and say, right, okay, today's not going to be great. I know what I need to do. You know, maybe I can look back and see the things that maybe I've neglected in the last few weeks that's got me to this point, and, you know, I crack on. Whereas you know, early on in the journey, there is those mornings where you kind of wake up and you kind of think like, oh God, like what's going to happen today? You know, it's almost panic stations.
Yeah.
But so like after uni and then moving into your cricket journey, Kate, did the sort of the pressures of the media scrutiny and stuff like that, did that kind of like ramp up that pressure on your mental state?
That didn't actually. It was me. It was my own thought processes and the way that I was, I guess, going, the way that I saw my career panning out was like this unobtainable goal that I'd set myself. And even now I'm still working through this kind of stuff. So please, you know, take what I say with a pinch of salt, because I'm still not quite there yet with it. But I like allowed this perfectionism to creep into my career that, like I said, is just unobtainable for anyone in sport. It's just not, literally not possible to be perfect. Yeah. And I kind of got to this point where I was so scared of learning new skills that I just didn't, and I never moved forward with my game. And I got to this point where, you know, I was kind of clinging onto selection, and I was getting game time, but I just wasn't the player that I should be, having been in the system for 3 or 4 years, and I wasn't getting any better. And I had to do a lot of work with our psych at the time then, and he kind of went into performance anxiety with me, and I said, I laughed at him. I said, I'm not anxious. I'm not like, I'm the most extroverted person that you'll ever meet. I'm the joker in the dressing room. You know, that's, anxiety is not my thing. And he kind of explained to me how much like anxiety and that buildup of pressure that you put on yourself kind of gets so full. He used a water tank analogy with me. So he said, you know, if you keep putting water into that water tank, it's going to overflow at some point. He said, what you've got to start doing is like opening the tap at the bottom and letting a little bit out. And for me, that was talking and being more aware of the goals that I'd set myself, or how I was acting in training and how I was trying to, you know, obtain that perfection. And so that was like another kind of phase of my mental health journey that I had to go through to now on the flip side. Well, on the other side of that, I've kind of got a bit more of my enjoyment back for why I started playing the game in the first place. You know, that kid that went down to the cricket club all weekend and loved it. I'd lost that completely. And I was thinking, oh, if my fitness testing isn't right, I'm not going to get selected. If my skin folds aren't good, I'm not going to get selected. I have to take wickets in this match, otherwise I'm not going to get selected. If I don't get selected, I'm not going on the next tour. If I'm not selected on the next tour, then my contract won't get renewed. And suddenly I'd got this spiral of like the worst case scenarios going on. This was all coming from not doing well in a fitness test. It was, you know, that ability to kind of like escalate a problem that wasn't even a problem. I was just making it a problem in my own head. So yeah, we had to kind of really unpick all that. And it was hard work. It was a lot of tough conversations. But yeah, again, I think like people don't see that side of professional sport. It's not even professional sport. It's any sport. I think everyone does it, whether it's your hobby or not. But I think we just kind of analyze everything we do all the time and forget why we're there, you know, forget the enjoyment factor, which is something that I've had to work really hard to kind of get back in the last couple of years.
Yeah, sure. I mean, to be honest, just hearing you like list all those sorts of things, I mean, that was exhausting. It, you know, you could see why that would be exhausting. You listed like thinking all those things over and over again. And I think energy is like, you know, it's so important. And one thing I realized that there's a difference between like physical energy and emotional energy. So I thought as long as my physical energy was up, I was like, well, I'm working and I'm going to the gym and I'm doing all these things, I feel great. But there's a different type of energy. And that's the energy that burns when your mind is just roaring round with all these things. And it's once that energy starts getting depleted, then, you know, things, it becomes quite hard to function.
Yeah. Spot on. And I think like I said, I was in the joker in the dressing room. So when I'm having a bad day, everyone noticed. And I would kind of get this feedback that it was like almost negative in a way, that people would say, oh, Crossy, when you're great, you are great. Everyone's with you. You know, you drag people around and it's great and you're up and your energy is like contagious. But then when you're down, geez, you don't half pull people down. You know, you take people with you. And so I'd been given this feedback by my teammates and I was thinking, I need to like find a way of masking this then. So then when I got out of bed and got to training, I was like, right, I'm going to be the best version of myself. So I'd go through the day and then I'd get back home and I'd literally like fall asleep straight away because it's so exhausting putting that mask on and being that person for everyone else. I wasn't looking after myself at all in that environment. I was looking after every other person in that squad because I was so aware of like my energy in the group. So and I think that kind of fits in with that burnout that you're talking about, that it's not even physical energy, because you can fuel, and we were, you know, provided with the right snacks and how to fuel training and things like that, but that wasn't what I needed. I needed my own space. I needed the safety of feeling like I could have a bad day and it'd be okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually my teammates then learned that me being that Mardy northerner wasn't my choice. You know, that was just happening to me, and I was still learning how to deal with it, and I needed their help as well to know that I was safe in that environment when that was happening.
Yeah, very much so. And it built up to the point where you took a bit of time off, Kate, is that right? Yeah,
so that was about 2016. So that was a really, really difficult time for me. It was probably like, I call it my big like mental breakdown. And I got to the point where I needed to speak to our head coach and to say, look, I'm not right. I can't carry on, again, kind of talking what we just touched on then, but I can't keep being this energy for the group because it's just draining me. And he made the decision for me to kind of get away from it. So this was about October 2016. And we had the World Cup at home in June 2017. So I knew that if I pulled myself out of selection for the winter tours going into the what would be the build-up for the World Cup in the summer, I knew I was jeopardising my place in the squad. And I had this like real battle, this like massive tug of war in my own head of, can I carry on and keep going? Because you've done 3 years now where you've managed to somehow get to this point. So can you keep going, or do you need to stop and get away from this? And thankfully he made the decision for me. So in hindsight, I didn't have the mental capacity to make that decision anyway, because I wanted to carry on. I wanted to make that World Cup squad. But on the back of that, I've literally missed out on probably what would have been the most amazing day of my career, because the girls went on to win that World Cup
home
in front of a packed Lourdes, you know, 25,000 people at Lourdes. And I'm never going to get that opportunity to play that World Cup at home ever again. So in terms of like my career, I'm still having those moments where I'm like battling between the regret of letting it get to where it got to for me to need to take a break. And also the, actually, no, you know, what could have been, had you carried on, what could have happened? And so I still like have those moments where I think, oh, I just wish I'd just kept my mouth shut and not say anything, because I could have a World Cup winner's medal. So, but it's all ifs and buts, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah. Hindsight's wonderful. Yeah. That tug of war you mentioned, I always like, that is something else that's huge, because people really get to that point where they can't, you know, I always describe it as if you've got any sort of job that you really, really hate, and you think, I can't come in and do this job anymore. You know, I hate the people I work with, I hate my manager, all this sort of stuff, but you can't quit because you've got a mortgage. You're just kind of like trapped in that middle ground where you can't go back and you can't go forward. And that really, really affects people. And I think when things get dark and people start having like suicidal thoughts and stuff like that, that's where that comes from, that feeling of being trapped in one place. And sometimes you have to make like a huge decision like you did, But that, you know, that is a decision. Yes, you might think about that now, but that, you know, it could well have, like, it could have saved you. I know that sounds like dramatic or whatever, but you had to make a decision, right? You just couldn't stay where you were.
And I think that's where I was lucky that I had the right support around me to help. Well, I know that the coach made that decision for me, but he didn't just see me one day and say, oh no. I was sat crying with him in a dressing room, not physically being able to go into the dining hall where all my teammates were because I couldn't face them. So I'd got to the point where, you know, he needed to make that decision for me. But I think now, I know I'm in a good place now, and it's very easy to say this, but I think I've worked really hard on trying to flip my mentality of, when I was in that bad place, I thought, what's the worst thing that happens here? I don't play in the World Cup. I don't, you know, get that winner's medal, whatever. Now I try and think of it as, like, what's the best thing that could happen if I make this decision? So for that person that you're talking about that's stuck in that job, yes, it might be the scariest thing in the world leaving it, but also you might find a job that you love and that you're absolutely passionate about. And, you know, what could the opportunity be if you decide to take that step? So it's a really scary place, but I also think it's a really empowering place as well, because, you know, you've got your own opportunities ahead of you.
Yeah, definitely. You're kind of almost like backing yourself to go on and just do something, you know, just to take control and get out of that dark place. Incredibly brave decision. Incredibly brave. And so what did you spend that time off doing in between? Was that a lot of, you know, a lot of self-care and self-work and all that sort of stuff?
So I literally ran away. I think this might have been like the Tuesday that I got told to, you know, have some time away. You're not going to be selected for this West Indies tour. So again, that's another like massive tick in the box that I'd lost, because you're going away for the winter and you go to Barbados and Antigua and all these amazing places. So, but I said to my mum and dad, I said, I need to get away from everything. I need to take myself out of this. There's no point me like going home and just mulling around at home and feeling sorry for myself. And I think I did just that. I didn't get out of bed for about 3 days after that. And then it got to like the Friday and I said to dad, I said, right, let's go somewhere. I said, let's book a flight and go somewhere. And we were in Barbados on the Monday and we did 10 days out there. So it was just this kind of, I'm better around sunshine anyway, you know, like vitamin D getting out. I'm terrible in our winter with the dark nights and dark mornings. So I suffer with SAD quite a lot anyway. So I thought, right, go and get some sunshine, get some vitamin D. And all I did for that 10 days was train. I just ran on the beach in the morning, sat by the pool, went to the gym in the afternoon. And that, like, exercise is my number one. It's the thing that's got me out of a lot of dark places. So I just thought, if I do 10 days of feeling better about myself and having some sunshine, then, you know, that's going to be a great start. But then in the kind of months leading out of that, that was when I was doing all that work with that psychologist about unpicking that performance anxiety. And that kind of went a little bit deeper as well into, well, he asked me about my childhood. And again, I laughed. I said, I had a great childhood. You know, I've got two older siblings who I love to bits. I've got a really supportive family. I was lucky. I got to travel the world. And then we kind of really went into it, and there was so much that, again, he told me this stuff and I kind of was blown away a little bit that he was able to tell me stuff about my own childhood that I'd lived through but didn't know was happening. Right. And we managed to unpick a lot of stuff, actually. So my dad being a professional footballer, we spoke about how everyone knew who I was before I was anything. So every time I turned up to play a game of cricket, I was David Cross's daughter. And I was David Cross's daughter who happened to be good at cricket. Right. I was also the only girl in that environment. So I was playing in a boys' team and stood out like a sore thumb because I had a ponytail. And I was the girl that played for Hayward. So, you know, before I've even bowled a ball, people were aware of me. And I always maintained that made me thrive, because I loved putting people, like shutting people up. And, oh, they've got a girl playing for them. They must be scraping the barrel. They mustn't have got a full team this week. That kind of chat that you hear. Well, I'm going to prove people wrong. No, I'm going to prove to you that I'm picked here on merit. And this is like in the under 11s. So this is how early this started. And then I remember I made my England debut when I was about 22. And in the programme that you get, it was everyone's got like a picture and how old they are and a little paragraph about them. And mine started with West Ham FA Cup winner David Crossy's daughter, Kate, played her cricket at. So right. The first sentence was about my dad. And so all this stuff that my psyche is telling me that this has really affected you, you know, you put that pressure that you're talking about that you put on yourself. I'm not surprised it's there because people were putting that pressure on you when you were 11. And like he just unraveled all this stuff for me. And I couldn't believe that this would take an effect on me. And it did. We did a lot of, I had to like sit with my mum and dad for a lot of these conversations and talk about how much pressure I felt when they came to watch me because I was so scared of letting them down. And it, again, my dad's that era where, you know, you kind of never talked about your feelings. And my dad sat there and like, I'm in tears and he's saying, Kate, we don't give a monkeys if you do well or not. You are representing England. You could be representing Hayward. You could be representing anybody and we still be proud of what you're doing. But I just never had these conversations with my parents. So it was awful, to be honest. It was lovely. Don't get me wrong. It was great hearing all that stuff, but it was just awful sitting there with your parents and kind of spieling all this stuff out that you didn't know was a thing. And for them to kind of react how they did, like my dad's brilliant now. He talks so much more about his own mental health. And when I put that post out on the weekend, he was the first one to tweet about it and say, you know, it's not weak to speak. And I think I've kind of changed his perceptions on what mental health is as well, because no one spoke about it when he was a professional footballer.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And, you know, it's not, you know, there must have been people who struggled then, right? It's just buried differently and tucked away differently and not discussed, you know?
Yeah, I've absolutely no doubt. I said that to him, actually. I said, do you think if you kind of were given the safety and the safe environments and the space to talk about things like this, do you think you would have either been a better footballer or had a longer career? Or, and he said that he thinks that it would have no doubt made him a better player, because a lot of it for him, because he was he calls himself an old school centre forward, like old school striker that was never scared to get hurt in the box. So he kind of had this persona on a Saturday when he went out that he was never scared of getting hurt. And he said, I'm like on a Saturday in a, if someone starts a fight with me in a pub, I'm the first one to leave. He said, I'm not interested in that. But he'd kind of created this persona that he played on the pitch. That was kind of just how they did it back then. It was never, you never talked about anything, or I don't think even mental health would have been a word back then, would it? It was probably seen as a disease or something.
Yeah. No, that's very true. Eh? Yeah. Yeah. There would have been probably like, like straitjacket connotations and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So, and you're right, man, this stuff is really, really hard. It's why it's called The Work, right? Cause it's tough. It's like physically exhausting as well as mentally exhausting when you start to unpick all this stuff. And I suppose it shows how complicated the human mind is. You know, we attach ourselves to these thoughts and, you know, they become the God's honest truth. And then when someone helps you question it, you kind of go, oh yeah, then maybe that's not true. And I've just built my entire life around it.
Yeah.
But oh mate. And then you start to work towards your comeback into the sport, right? So that you come out the other side, so to speak.
Yeah. And that's, again, it's really easy to talk about that because I'm still here. I managed to keep holding my contract through those 2 years. I don't think I played international cricket for about 18 months. But again, and I probably don't talk about this enough, but talking is obviously great when it comes to mental health, but there's also a lot of hard work that goes into changing your processes, which is a lot of, you know, I was talking about flipping that mindset of the, I always used to see things as negative and as a risk rather than seeing it as that reward and opportunity. And so I've had to do a lot of work in, first of all, noticing when I am feeling like that and when I'm talking to myself like that, but also then being able to change how I talk to myself. So there was obviously a lot of hard work that went into that. But on that, a lot of it was going back to that kid that played cricket because she loved cricket and she loved spending time with the mates down at Hayward. So I would say I've kind of had two halves of my career, like the one before my mental health breakdown and then the one after that. And there's just been so much more enjoyment in the last 3 or 4 years. You know, I've taken everything at face value and almost like, it sounds really cliche and I hate saying it, but like, you never know when your last game's going to be. So when you get out there, just treat it like it's going to be your last game, because I had did 18 months thinking I'm never going to play cricket for England again. I'm not good enough to do that. And also I've lost my shirt basically. So I'm not going to get back into the team. And I think when you do all the physical hard work, all the mental hard work, it then makes you enjoy it a lot more, because there's that, I wouldn't say release of pressure, but you've just, you know, you've done the hard work. So yeah, it does make it that little bit more enjoyable. And don't get me wrong, like I said, I'm not perfect with all this yet. And I've still, you know, I get out there and I'm put so much pressure on myself to do well for my team and stuff. But I think my perspectives on it have just all changed a bit now. And I'm, you know, I'm just more aware of, I guess, the luxury that I've got to be able to play sport for a living, but also it's just not the be all and end all. You know, it is a game of cricket at the end of the day. And it's that perspective can be lost so easily when you engulf your life in cricket.
Yeah, it's really interesting actually when you're doing that self work, because you do a lot of work to get well, and then when you're like in a better place, it's like all the work you've done pays off, because you then have all these tools to apply when you're in a good place. So you use them to get you to a level, and then when you're on that level that you can navigate life, then you've have or learned all this stuff about behavior and life. Sometimes, you know, even by going through these really dark periods, you can come out the other side and things can be better. And I think that that's not, you know, not talked about enough as well. You know, you do that work, and you just carry that, all that stuff, all these tools with you going forward, right? Into life.
I have no doubt that I'm a better person for having gone through those struggles, because like you said, like the tools that I've learned, like even things like driving, I used to be the angriest driver. Like if someone pulled out in front of me or didn't let me out or whatever it would be, I would be like beeping my horn and getting really frustrated. Whereas now it just, like, I've got the ability to just take a step back and go, right, maybe that person is in a rush today. Maybe something's gone on in their life that you don't know about, that they've, you know, that's why they've done that. Maybe they're a terrible driver. You don't know. But, you know, I kind of then like, right, just relax. It's not affected you. Like it actually doesn't matter. You've not hurt. You've not been hurt. The car's fine. So, you know, get over it. And it's actually like just little things like that that have crept into my life that I now I'm able to deal with just so much more relaxed and sensibly, I guess, than, you know, this crazy little kid that was driving around and getting frustrated with everyone. But it's just it's all in all parts of my life now. It's not just in my cricket. And if I'm grateful for anything about mental health, it is that I think I've become a better person because of it.
Yeah, completely. It makes you a lot more compassionate, doesn't it? You start to see things through. I mean, yeah, you start to see the world through like other people's eyes. And like you say, maybe they are having a bad day. And I don't know if you're the same, but I can kind of like see signs in people. Sometimes someone will say something, or they'll phrase something a certain way, or they'll have a look about them. And I think, oh, it looks like they're having a bit of a bad day. You know, maybe they might not know it. I'm not going around diagnosing people or anything, but, you know, you can get kind of like a feel for when someone else is struggling a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I do a little bit of research before these recordings. I try not to do too much, because I try and, like, you know, take you somewhere else rather than have the same interview and over and over again. But one thing I did notice doing a bit of reading up on yourself was that a lot of your teammates have also had mental health problems, a couple of other people in the team. And it seemed as if about once people started talking about it, then you all could kind of realize and be there for each other a bit more. And you know, was that the case? If I kind of got that right?
Yeah. I think the norm of mental health, just, I guess that goes to show that it's, you know, if it's happening in a sports dressing room and there's 13, 14 of us normally on a tour. So if you've got 10 people in that dressing room who are struggling in one way or another with whatever it might be. I think it just, for me, hits home that it is part of everyone's life in some way. But I think the big thing for us was starting to talk to each other, and like that feedback that I was telling you about, that was a really difficult time for me, because I was so aware of what people were saying to me, but I couldn't tell them why I was like that. And then when we started kind of being a bit more vulnerable in front of each other, I think it explained it a lot better to people, so that now when people see me at training, if I'm flat, everyone's like, are you okay? And I'll go, honestly, I am fine. I'm just shattered today. But you know what? I need your help today. I need you to try and get me through this session as best I can. But 5 years ago, I was getting a telling off because I was being flat. So kind of just how we talk to each other has completely changed as well, because we've got, I keep talking about a safe environment, but we've got that environment now that allows people to be okay talking about it. which I think is really special, actually. And I, again, wouldn't take that for granted, because I know a lot of people in their workplaces might not necessarily have that. So, but again, that was hard work. That was us sitting down and learning how to recognize those signs in each other. And that's not easy to do, especially when you've got 20 girls in this environment that, you know, we've all come from different walks of life, and our common goal is cricket. That's our literally our common denominator. It's not, we're not always best mates. We just share a dressing room. So it's,
yeah, sure.
Yeah. So it can be quite difficult as well to recognize that in like that these girls aren't my best mates. You know, I spend a lot of time with them, and we live in each other's pockets a lot, and we get on each other's nerves, but yeah, they're not my absolute best mate. So it can be quite difficult to do.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I love that being able to say you're having a bad day is huge. Partly so you can get that space, get that help or whatever, but also so you don't have to lie. Because if you can just come out and say I'm having a bad day, you don't have to say you're not when you are, you know, and that's massive, you know. That's really, really, really cool. What do you have anything? You mentioned exercise before. Do you have like any like management tools that particularly work for you? Obviously, this is really, really like individual, but for Kate Cross, what kind of works for you?
So when I'm in that really, really bad place, I should do this more often, and I tell myself off for not doing it, but meditation is a big one for me. So I use Headspace. And when I was really struggling back in 2016, our psych then told me that meditation was as effective as medication over a 6-week period. So I never wanted to go on medication. It was just, a thing that I had in my head that I didn't want to rely on tablets. So I said, I'll try this. And then I couldn't tell you why, I can't tell you how, but after that 6 weeks, I was in a better place. So meditation is a big one for me. Exercise, there's been times where I've gone out at literally 10 p.m. and I call it a panic run. I go out on a panic run and just for whatever reason I feel better when not that the world is fixed, but I feel better when I come back and I'm able to just relax a bit more. A big thing for me is my food. When I'm not eating well and like hydrating myself, I know that's a big part of my job anyway, but if I just let that slip a little bit, I'm generally not, I feel worse in myself, which then kind of triggers a few things. And the other thing is my sleep. I'm so big on sleep. I need good sleep, and I need quite a lot of it. So having those kind of bedtime routines that are good, you know, not watching telly until 10 p.m., but trying to read my book, get in bed a little bit earlier, that kind of thing. And just continually talking. I know it sounds really easy. I think when you're in that place, you realize that it's not easy. And I think that's sometimes quite hard for people who've not experienced mental health properly. You know, it's hard for people to grasp how difficult it can be to just talk about what you're going through. Because like we said earlier, you don't know half the time. You can't articulate it that well sometimes. But yeah, I'd say that they're my main things. But exercise is just the one. That's, you know, when I'm feeling fit and fighting fit, I'm just better in myself generally. So.
Yeah. No, I think it's huge. I think it's no coincidence that all those things are like very natural human stuff, like eating, sleeping, you know, all those sorts of, all those things, you know. And I think the further we get away from the norm, we get taken away. Life sometimes takes us away from these things, doesn't it? You know, you don't have time to exercise, eating on the run and stuff like that. But yeah, if you stick to those basics, then it really is a good foundation for doing that work, I think.
Yeah, I think having those routines that you can rely on are so important, because there's, like I said, I don't meditate every day. I meditate when I'm not in a good place. So then I wish I was better at doing it, and I tell myself to do it, but I just for some reason don't. But then I know that when I am struggling, I'll go back to that. And then it's almost like a right start again, reset yourself kind of thing. So, but like you said, it's so individual, and everything is kind of different for different people. And, I don't think I'd be able to kind of get myself out of these ruts as easily if I'd not done that really hard work back in 2016 to change those thought processes and how I view the world. So, you know, it's not just a quick fix, and it's not just a, you know, go out for a run and you're going to sort everything sorted. I think there's kind of levels to it that you've got to work quite hard at. But it's like anything, if you want to get fit, you've got to work hard for it. You know,
it's exactly
the same with your brain. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's an absolutely awesome place to draw a line under it there, mate. But yeah, just to finish up, what's in the offing for cricket wise? When's the next World Cup?
So we've got the 50 over World Cup, which was supposed to be February just gone. It got postponed because of COVID. So that's happening now next February over in New Zealand. So we've actually got a really busy 12, 18 months because we've got the Commonwealth Games in 2022 as well, which it's the first time that... I don't think the men's team are in it, actually. I think it's just women's cricket that's being represented there. So that'll be a pretty amazing experience. So we've got lots to look forward to.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, well, thank you so much for your time today, Kate. I really, really appreciate it. And
no problem.
Yeah, really mad respect for your honesty. That was awesome. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks, Tom.